This week on Straight Talk Africa, South Africa presides over the G20. The crisis in Sudan and the Democratic Republic of Congo deepen. The U.S. African Growth and Opportunity Act is up for renewal. And
this year, we suffered a lot.
Young Africans all over the continent are demanding change. What will be Africa's challenges and opportunities in 2025? Straight Talk Africa starts right now. Welcome to Straight Talk Africa, coming to you from our headquarters in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Vincent McCorry. Today, we'll take a look at major events and trends that are shaping the political and economic landscape on the African continent in 2025. This month, we will see the political balance shifting in the Sahel. On January 29th, Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger are scheduled to exit the Economic Community of West African States, also known as ECOWAS, after refusing the bloc's demand to restore democratic rule. The three countries established a new defense and cooperation body, the Alliance of Sahel States. This year, South Africa will be first African country to preside over G20, and many believe it will voice the interests of the countries of the Global South. For insight into this new realities, I'm joined here in studio by Zainab Usman, Director for the Africa Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and by Piwo Hule Minyandu, Assistant Director, Center for African Studies, Howard University, who has been tracking the influence of China on the continent. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Straight Talk Africa. So if I may start with you, Usman, and both of you can actually chime in. We did mention the little shift in the Sahel region with these three countries, Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, saying they're going to exit ECOWAS, and they formed their own alliance. What is that going to do to the kind of the geopolitical landscape of that region? Mm-hmm.
The tensions between those three countries, Mali, Burkina Faso, Republic of Niger, and the rest of ECOWAS, is quite significant. It's a major rupture for the community. This is perhaps the first major rupture, perhaps since the tensions with Mauritania a couple of years ago. It's going to be really significant if they do exit. Because ECOWAS is really based on regional integration for West Africa, free movement of people. So that is going to be very, very significant. Mm-hmm. It's also going to be a major indictment on one of the major powers in ECOWAS, which is Nigeria. Nigeria is often seen as like the big brother in ECOWAS, and in fact, these tensions are very much underlined by perceptions around how Nigeria has managed the bloc. And as we speak, an important source of tension is also the role of France in all of this. The fact that these countries, for a variety of reasons, whether it's historical, whether it's a military-oriented, whether it's geopolitics, perceptions that they're trying to remove the final kind of shackles of neocolonialism, as they would say. You know, people would also disagree with that characterization. At the same time, France is really increasing its ties with other countries in the region, Nigeria in particular. Mm-hmm. So how all of these dynamics shape up would really affect what happens on the 29th of January.
Yes, and such moves also obviously have some ramifications, because we know there was the whole arrangement for security between the Western nations and the Sahel regions to fight against the jihadists, and the whole of the continent is watching this development. So what does that talk tell us about perhaps what could be happening in terms of how some Africans are perceiving the Western influence or control over African countries in some situations?
Well, I would say if a cynical view would be that, well, this is a natural renegotiation of powers, a strategic renegotiation. The Africans may see this as a snowball effect of what began with the coups in these countries. And a consequence of that is that it may spread and it may make other countries, may give them an example to which to follow, to kind of spurn the West if they would like. But an optimistic view is that this presents an opportunity for countries like Ghana to be interlocutors. And if you were watching the inauguration of President Mahama, you saw that Captain Traore attended. There was a warm welcome. So Ghana stands poised to actually be an interlocutor in this crisis to avoid further crises.
Mm-hmm. Very significant country in the region, too. And now, one other thing that we're going to talk about this year, obviously it's months away, is South Africa hosting the G20. Now, we know that South Africa is the only African country that is a member of the G20, but what does this really mean for the continent, for the rest of the countries of Africa that are not members of G20 anyway?
Sure. I think there's also a bit of context here. Let's remember that in 2023, the African Union was admitted as a member. Well, the kind of efforts began to admit the African Union as a member of the G20. This happened in 2024. And the advocacy for admitting the African Union was made by a number of countries, including South Africa. So South Africa has been a leading voice for the African continent on the G20 as the only member at the time, and then for the making the case for the admission of the African Union. And now having South Africa host the G20, I think is going to be another feather in the cap of South Africa's leadership on that role. Mm-hmm. But also stepping a little bit away from the G20, South Africa is a member of BRICS, and it hosted the BRICS summit again in 2023. And across all of these fora, South Africa has been able to champion certain important causes on behalf of the African continent, whether it's with respect to, the debt and development financing, whether it's with respect to climate action, but very importantly, with respect to representation of Africa and African voices in systems and institutions of global governance. Maybe one final thing I would say is that the geopolitics has also changed and evolved significantly, now in January 2025. Over the past 1 year plus with the war in Gaza, South Africa took Israel to the ICJ, and that has added a lot more color to the entire geopolitical environment. And then South Africa still maintains very strong relations with Russia, which has caused a lot of consternation here in D.C., mm-hmm. but also in other Western capitals. Yeah. So those are, I think, a few contextual factors that I thought to highlight.
Yeah, South Africa is certainly one of the stubborn boys of the continent, right? Pio happens to come from South Africa, so the kid in Durban or somewhere in Kaduna may wonder, okay, so G20, Africa, South Africa, so what?
Well, South Africa has a long tradition since the days of Tata Nelson Mandela. There's a long tradition of punching above its weight. Thanks to the miracle of South Africa's transition to democracy, it has always carried a sort of moral high ground on many issues, and it's highly regarded, both in the West and in the East and in the Global South especially. So it is an arrow in its quiver that it often uses, and sometimes much to the, as my colleague has said, much to the consternation of some observers in the West. But it is an equal opportunity foreign policy player, South Africa is. However, events, for example, in Mozambique, I would say, they kind of put a damper on an optimistic take on South Africa being a leader. If South Africa can't take care of things in its neighborhood, so this is a test for South Africa. If it is to assume what it has always thought was natural, kind of this leadership position on the African continent, it must demonstrate that it's able to assume leadership in the region.
Mm-hmm. Very good. And now, talking about the region and some of the issues that perhaps might be significant in terms of the economic engagement, most of African countries, especially the youth, are more interested in how do we benefit in terms of some of those issues that you mentioned. And economically, does it really have any immediate implications?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. when it comes to African economies and you look at a number of indicators, you could end up with a very mixed picture, so to speak. At a very macro level, 9 out of the world's 20 fastest growing economies are in Africa, including those in West Africa and also a lot of countries in East Africa, even Ethiopia, Tanzania, and a few others. So the situation is not that bad. But then when you look at other indicators such as the levels of debt distress, there are quite a number of countries. I think something in the region of maybe 20 or so are at risk of debt distress or are already in debt distress, right? Governments are running out of money, so to speak, and some of it is a holdover of the impacts of COVID and the disruptions around trade. Some of the countries are making a lot of significant debt service payments that often exceed what they spend on healthcare and social services. Mm-hmm. And then when you look at another indicator, and I'll bring all of these together, surveys done by entities like Afrobarometer on what young people want, what Africans generally want and what young people want. Usually the top three items are good jobs, good healthcare, and then something to do with the economy. Mm-hmm. So cost of living, inflation in quite a number of countries, Nigeria, Ghana, this is quite significant. How governments deliver is going to be very important, but also how the international community supports African countries will absolutely be crucial here.
And we'll expound a bit on this and also with the debt issue and the place that, the role China and the West may be playing in this. But it's time for a short break. When we return, we'll continue our discussion on the major events and political realities that are shaping the socioeconomic landscape on the African continent in 2025.
In times of change, when the world seems uncertain, and what we hear doesn't reflect what we see, we seek the truth. When we are told only part of the story, we lose trust. In moments of crisis, our dreams, hopes, and wishes for a better tomorrow depend on a free press. At Voice of America, we bring you the stories that people take risks to see. We connect the world and unite it with truth. At Voice of America, we show you the whole picture.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Linoch Mudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
You're watching VOA's Red Carpet. My name is Jackson Vunganyi. Thank you so much for joining us each week right here on Red Carpet. We bring you the latest in
As a lawyer, first of all, I would like to see improved respect for constitutionalism and rule of law. Secondly, this is a year when politics is going to be at center stage in this country. I would like to see its processes and systems that are geared towards achieving free, fair, credible, and respectable elections in our country.
Drastic improvement in infrastructure in the city. Our city has very, very bad roads. It has a lot of traffic congestion because of poor infrastructure. We have a dilapidated healthcare system. We hope that in 2025, bigger efforts can be diverted towards improving the healthcare system.
I need to see change in the way we manage rubbish in the society, because this damages the environment. It causes more carbon dioxide in the air, which affects us, sometimes making us sick.
I want to see a country or a leadership of our country respect more the rule of law in our country. And being that we are headed for elections, I would really like to see a change, a better transformation, probably even the first change of power that is bloodless in Uganda, because we've never had one.
I would love to see change in the motorcycle riders in our country. It is the quickest way for us we use to get to our workplaces because of a lot of jam. But these riders don't have discipline. They don't follow traffic rules and regulations. They're indisciplined as people. Sometimes they are vulgar. By the time you get to work, you're still thinking about the journey you had in the morning before you go to work.
Two topmost on my list is transportation and feeding, the price of foodstuff, the cost of foodstuff. But firstly, the transportation is so expensive from 2024, and it caused a lot of havoc and job and lack of job, because a lot of people had to leave their jobs due to the fact that transport was taking almost all the money, and it's so unfair on the poor masses.
This 2025, we wish to see better things from the government, especially reduction in fuel prices and foodstuff. That is the areas that we have obstacles, seriously. Food and fuel and transportation. We know that the high cost is caused by the fuel prices.
If you look at the condition of the country, things are not that okay. But our prayer is that we need positive. That's just it.
Welcome back here with Straight Talk Africa, coming to you from our headquarters in Washington, D.C. We are discussing the major socioeconomic and political currents that are shaping the African continent in 2025. I'm joined by Zainab Osman, Director for the Africa Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and by Piokule Nyandu, Assistant Director, Center for African Studies, Howard University. We just heard citizens in Nigeria and Uganda asking for change, for jobs, yearning for a government that works for the people. Is this year going to be another year of promises? Now, Pure, you know, you've heard all those promises. And just before we went to break, our sister here talked about the debt burden. Most of the African countries, of course, are grappling with the debt. And we just saw the Chinese foreign minister, Wang Yi, start his trip this week in Africa. He was going to Namibia, taking him to Chad, Nigeria, and the Republic of Congo. And one of the things people are saying is that China is trying to help African countries deal with these debt issues. And we know that it has been heavy also on building infrastructure, which some of the people said they want better roads, they want better infrastructure. So is this year going to be a year when China might have even more push into Africa than before?
I'd say naturally so, because if you look at the recently concluded Communist Party Congress, there were 10 action plans that were posited by Xi Jinping. And out of those 10, 2, 1 and 8 are about soft power. So China is quite aware, and the Chinese being good students, they've heard the criticism that you are after African resources and you need to renegotiate some of these debt traps, as some have described them. So they're taking a two-track route. One, they're going to strengthen their messaging, their PR around these issues. And we're going to see a lot of joint exercises that are purely based on soft power initiatives. But secondly, they're going to actually help. We'll see. It remains to be seen whether this works out in the end or not. But they're going to be more transparent with how these deals go. And I think that's, if you're looking as an African, it's China responding to this quite correct criticism of these debt traps that some Africans feel like they've led themselves to. But also, more strategically, China has identified electric vehicles as basically a big pathway towards gaining more market share on the African continent. And if you look at the African continent, they're young, they're hip, they're woke, and they're connected with the world. They care about the environment. Surveys have shown that 80% of African youth believe that something must be done about the environment and we must adopt more electric vehicles. So if you're looking at electric vehicles, they actually play in the hands of a resurgent China.
Yeah. Now, in terms of China and then the West, you cannot talk about China and Africa without also talking about the U.S. and other Western powers. And not long ago, President Joe Biden visited Angola, and the Lobito Corridor is a kind of a big investment. And some are saying the U.S. model might be more beneficial for African countries than the Chinese model. And, of course, incoming President Donald Trump, he says, people say he is more of a business person than aid, and Africans need more of that. So what would you say?
Speaking about development models, if you look at what Africans are saying per surveys by Afrobarometer, I think the last time they asked that question was probably in 2021 about which model of development Africans prefer. And they overwhelmingly prefer the American model of development by, I can't remember the numbers, but slightly higher than the Chinese model, which is also quite popular. But when it comes to surveys about influence, which country is regarded as more influential, or which country is which country's influence is preferred, then China now ranks higher than the U.S. So it's very interesting, and you can make of those results what you want. But what it means here concretely in terms of how the U.S. engages with Africa is that a lot of Africans want more U.S. engagement, particularly around the areas they care about, jobs, economic opportunity, etc. The problem is that the way America engages with Africa sometimes aligns with those priorities. A lot of times it just is informed by a lot of other priorities. So when you look at the actual numbers of U.S. economic engagement, in FY 2022, for example, the U.S. provided about $17 billion of aid bilaterally to Africa. That's a lot. And aid has been increasing steadily. FDI, foreign direct investment, has not been increasing. It plunged over the 2010s and has only started to trend upwards. Trade as well. U.S.-Africa trade has been on a declining trend since at least 2010. In fact, in 2023, trade between the U.S. and Africa was just about $70 billion. Trade between China and Africa within that time reached a record high of $282 billion. So the problem is Africans want American engagement. Increasingly, the U.S. is starting to realize that it needs to do better and it needs to engage with Africa differently. The issue is that the tools for U.S. engagement with Africa have not evolved as quickly enough.
Phil, one of the tools, of course, has been AGOA. And maybe you want to chime in on what she said, along with that, the time for renewal for AGOA is now. And some people have been a little bit anxious about whether it will happen.
Well, I think it's a sport among analysts. Every time there's a new administration in Washington, everyone speculates and says, oh, is AGOA going up or is it going down? Look, the reality is that these Africa and the United States, they need each other as partners in this world. And Africa, there are certain expertise that are only found from the United States. And the Africans know this, as my colleague has said, and they would like some of these. And Africans actually have a fondness for certain things that are that we associate with the United States. But where the rubber hits the road in development, AGOA is actually an opportunity to show goodwill, to show that America has not lost Africa when it comes to things that matter the most. So if AGOA is pragmatic, if it's practical, if it's developmental and aspirational, most importantly, being able to find out what each African country would like out of it, then I think it's likely to stay and not just stay, but to succeed as far as the Africans are concerned.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of what all these things mean for Africans, you know, the economic trends, the engagements with the China, the U.S. and other Western nations, you know, the whole question is about how does this serve the interest of the Africans, especially the young people. We talked about the young people who are very educated, very woke. We've seen restless youth in Africa. We saw an example in Kenya with a massive protest for, you know, demanding, you know, better economic conditions. We've seen this in Nigeria. We've had voices all over the continent. What opportunities do exist for African leaders, especially when they consider that Africa is the youngest continent in the whole world?
That really is the key question, right? What countries and which leaders are prioritizing the interests of the young people in their countries? So if you look at the demographic distribution of most countries on the continent, maybe less so like parts of Southern Africa that are a little bit more advanced, like demographically, you find that something in the region of 60-70% of the entire population is comprised of people under the age of 30. So there's a huge challenge there of creating economic opportunities, creating jobs. And to do that, you need investments, you need infrastructure, you need the private sector, you need small and medium-scale enterprises to be thriving and to be productive. So all of these things are interconnected. The question is, which leaders are prioritizing these? And I don't think there are that many, unfortunately. There are those that are trying very hard.
Yeah.
There are those that just, you know, have a number of other priorities.
Mm-hmm.
So that really is the key question right now.
And Pio, you know, when we talk about the observations of the young people that we talked to, including those who really protested, were saying, here's a continent where we kind of crying every day about our level of poverty, but our leadership lives in opulence. They swim in billions, and it doesn't make sense that you can't provide jobs and services and tell us that, you know, our economy is suffering, we need to tighten our belts, but at the same time, you're flying high. What must African leaders do in order to really kind of come at the same level of thinking with the youth of Africa?
I'll use an example. In 2021, I mailed a book to a professor friend of mine in South Africa. That book returned to my house in November 2024. It was returned to sender. I was sending it to South Africa. So it took 3 years for a book sent from the United States to South Africa to come back by mail. Now imagine I'm a young South African and I'd like to start a business on Etsy and sell sandals to the United States. Right there, I've been cut at the knees. So I would say African leaders, I'm using South Africa as an example, but African leaders need to stay with the basics. Fix the infrastructure for commerce. A simple fix is the post. Just fix the mailing system, because the African youth are interconnected and they like to trade without sometimes the government as being without the attenuating effects of government. So I've given you a clear example here.
Yeah.
They must stick with the basics of commerce.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if I may add to that excellent and compelling anecdote he mentioned, very striking actually. Infrastructure is so important. You know, sometimes when we talk about infrastructure, we just think, you know, you're building stuff for the sake mm-hmm. of building stuff. No, you know, there are farmers who need to connect, who need to move their products to yes. markets somewhere in a bigger urban center. They need roads. They need cold storage facilities. Many parts of West Africa, farmers, you know, harvest produce before they get to market. Mm-hmm. Everything is, you know, has perished.
Yeah.
So you need connectivity infrastructure.
And I think that's a good place to end this conversation. Thank you very much. We have to leave it here. Thank you both for the thought-provoking discussion. We appreciate your time. Zena Bozeman, Director for the Africa Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and Pio Khunle Nyando, Assistant Director, Center for African Studies, Howard University. Thanks to our affiliate stations for broadcasting Free Talk Africa across the continent.